never, ever give up. You're never too old to chase your dreams. And even if something looks like a solitary sport, it's a team effort. Words to live by. Still, is this how I wanted to spend my time? Did I really want to put myself back in front of the firing squad of national politics for years on end, first in the campaign and then hopefully in the White House? Some of my dearest friends, including my longtime advisors and former chiefs of staff in the White House and the State Department, Maggie Williams and Cheryl Mills, told me I would be crazy to do it. Plenty of other people in my position had passed up the chance to run. Everyone from General Colin Powell to Mike Bloomberg to New York Governor Mario Cuomo, who came so close to running he had an airplane waiting on the tarmac to take him to New Hampshire when he finally decided no. So, why did I do it? I did it because when you clear away all the petty and not-so-petty reasons not to run, all the headaches, all the obstacles, what was left was something too important to pass up. It was a chance to do the most good I would ever be able to do. In just one day at the White House, you can get more done for more people than in months anywhere else. We had to build an economy that worked for everyone and an inclusive society that respected everyone. We had to take on serious national security threats. There were issues already on my mind all the time, and they would all require a strong, qualified president. I knew I would make the most of every minute. Once I started thinking about it that way, I couldn't stop. As it happened, the person who gave me the chance to serve as Secretary of State would once again play a decisive role. A month after I left the State Department in 2013, Barack and Michelle invited Bill and me to join them for a private dinner in the White House residence. The four of us talked about our kids and the experience of raising them in the fishbowl of the White House. We discussed life after the Oval Office. Barack and Michelle mused about maybe one day moving to New York, just as we had done. That prospect still felt very far away. We all had high hopes for Barack's second term. There was a lot of unfinished business, both at home and around the world. We ended up staying for hours, talking late into the night. If, back in the heated days of 2008, any of us could have gotten a glimpse of that evening, we wouldn't have believed it. Over the next year or so, the president and I kept in regular touch. He invited me back for lunch that summer, and the two of us sat out on the terrace, outside the Oval Office, eating jambalaya. I think he was just a tiny bit jealous of my newfound freedom, which was a good reminder of how all-consuming the job is. We had lunch again the following spring. Some of the time, the president and I talked about work, especially the foreign policy challenges he was facing in the second term. But gradually, as 2013 turned into 2014, our conversations turned more frequently to politics. President Obama knew the challenges facing Democrats. He never took his reelection for granted, and while it was a resounding win in 2012, the legitimately resounding kind, he knew that his legacy depended to a large degree on a Democratic victory in 2016. He made it clear that he believed that I was our party's best chance to hold the White House and keep our progress going, and he wanted me to move quickly to prepare to run. I knew President Obama thought the world of his vice president, Joe Biden, and was close to some other potential candidates, so his vote of confidence meant a great deal to me. We had our differences in both style and substance, but overwhelmingly, we shared the same values and policy goals. We both saw ourselves as pragmatic progressives trying to move the country forward in the face of implacable opposition from a Republican Party that had been taken over by the radical conservative Tea Party fringe and was enthralled to its billionaire backers. I shared the president's sense of urgency about how much was at stake in 2016, but I still wasn't entirely sold that running was the right decision for me. As I had found when he insisted that I become Secretary of State and literally wouldn't take no for an answer, President Obama is a persuasive and persistent advocate. In the summer of 2013, David Plouffe, Obama's former campaign manager, who engineered my defeat in 2008, offered to provide any help and advice he could as I planned my next steps after leaving the State Department. I invited him over to my house in Washington and quickly saw why the president had leaned on him so much. He really knew his stuff. We met again in September 2014 when he visited my house once more to give me a presentation about what it would take to build a winning presidential campaign. He spoke in detail about strategy, data, personnel, and timing. I listened carefully, determined that if I did jump into the race, I would avoid the mistakes that had dogged me the last time. Plouffe emphasized that time was of the essence, as hard as that was to believe, more than 2 years before the election. In fact, he said I was late already and urged me to get started. He was right. For me, political campaigns have always been something to get through in order to be able to govern, which is the real prize. I'm not the most natural politician. I'm a lot better than I'm usually given credit for, but it's true that I've always been more comfortable talking about others rather than myself. That made me an effective political spouse, surrogate, and office holder, but I had to adjust when I became a candidate myself. At the beginning, I had to actively try to use the word I more. Luckily, I love meeting people, listening, learning, building relationships, working on policy, and trying to help solve problems. I would have loved to meet all 320 million Americans one at a time, but that's not how campaigns work. In the end, I came back to the part that's most important to me. We Methodists are taught to do all the good you can. I knew that if I ran and won, I could do a world of good and help an awful lot of people. Does that make me ambitious? I guess it does. But not in the sinister way that people often mean it. I did not want to be president because I want power for power's sake. I wanted power to do what I could to help solve problems and prepare the country for the future. It's audacious for anyone to believe he or she should be president, but I did. I started calling policy experts, reading thick binders of memos, and making lists of problems that needed more thought. I got excited thinking about all the ways we could make the economy stronger and fairer, improve health care and expand coverage, make college more affordable and job training programs more effective, and tackle big challenges such as climate change and terrorism. It was honestly a lot of fun. I talked with John Podesta, a longtime friend who had been Bill's chief of staff in the White House and was also a top advisor to President Obama. If I was going to do this again, I would need John's help. He promised that if I ran, he'd leave the White House and become chairman of my campaign. He thought we could put together a fantastic team very quickly. An energetic grassroots group called Ready for Hillary was already drumming up support. All of that was very reassuring. I thought back to what made me run for Senate the first time. It was the late 1990s, and Democrats in New York were urging me to run, but I kept turning them down. No First Lady had ever done anything like that before, and I hadn't run for office since I'd been student government president at Wellesley College. One day, I visited a school in New York with the tennis star Billie Jean King for an event promoting an HBO special about women in sports. Hanging above our heads was a big banner proclaiming the title of the film, Dare to Compete. Before my speech, the 17-year-old captain of the high school basketball team introduced me. Her name was Sophia Totti. As we shook hands, she bent down and whispered in my ear, "Dare to compete, Mrs. Clinton, dare to compete." Something just clicked. For years, I had been telling young women to step up, participate, go for what you believe in. How could I not be willing to do the same? 15 years later, I was asking myself the same question. There wasn't one dramatic moment when I declared, "I'm doing it." Bill and I closed out 2014 with a trip to the beautiful home of our friends, Oscar and Annette De La Renta, in the Dominican Republic. We swam, ate good food, played cards, and thought about the future. By the time we got back, I was ready to run. The most compelling argument is the hardest to say out loud. I was convinced that both Bill and Barack were right when they said I would be a better president than anyone else out there. I also thought I'd win. I knew that Republicans had moved much further from the vital center of American politics than Democrats had, as nonpartisan political scientists have documented. But I still believed that the United States was a pretty sensible country. Previous generations faced much worse crises than anything we've seen, from the Civil War to the Great Depression, from World War II to the Cold War, and they responded by electing wise and talented leaders. Only rarely have Americans got carried away by extremes or enthralled by ideology, and never for long. Both major political parties, despite the madness of their respective nominating processes, nearly always managed to weed out the most extreme candidates. Before 2016, we'd never elected a president who flagrantly refused to abide by the basic standards of democracy and decency. If I was the best qualified candidate, had good ideas about the future, held my own on the trail and in the debates, and demonstrated a capacity to get things done with both Republicans and Democrats, it was reasonable to believe I could get elected and be able to govern effectively. That's why I ran. There are things I regret about the 2016 campaign, but the decision to run isn't one of them. I started this chapter with some lines from T.S. Eliot's poem, East Coker, that I've always loved. There is only the fight to recover what has been lost and found and lost again and again, and now under conditions that seem unpropitious, but perhaps neither gain nor loss. For us, there is only the trying. The rest is not our business. When I first read that, as a teenager in Park Ridge, Illinois, it struck a chord somewhere deep inside, maybe in that place where dim ancestral memories of indomitable Welsh and English coal miners hid alongside half-understood stories from my mother's childhood of privation and abandonment. There is only the trying. I went back to that poem a few years later in 1969 when my classmates at Wellesley asked me to speak at our graduation. Many of us were feeling dismayed and disillusioned by the Vietnam War and the racial injustice in America, the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, and our seeming inability to change our country's course. My paraphrasing gave Eliot's elegant English verse a Midwestern makeover. There's only the trying, I told my classmates, again and again and again, to win again what we've lost before. In the nearly 50 years since, it's become a mantra for me and our family that win or lose, it's important to get caught trying. Whether you're trying to win an election or pass a piece of legislation that will help millions of people, build a friendship, or save a marriage, you're never guaranteed success, but you are bound to try again and again and again. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I live. Life is no brief candle to me. It is a sort of splendid torch which I have got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. George Bernard Shaw. Getting started. You could say my campaign for president began with a snappy internet video filmed in April 2015 outside my home in Chappaqua. Or you could point to my formal announcement speech that June on Roosevelt Island in New York. But I think it started with something a lot more ordinary, a Chipotle burrito bowl. If you're wondering what I'm talking about, you probably don't spend much time in the carnival funhouse of cable and internet news. It was April 13, 2015, in Maumee, Ohio. Chipotle was a pit stop on my road trip from New York to Iowa, home of the first in the nation caucus. It was a purposefully low-key trip. No press, no crowds, just me, a few staff, and Secret Service agents. We bundled into an oversized black van I call Scooby because it reminds me of the Scooby-Doo mystery machine. Our van has less shaggy, psychedelic charm, but we love it just the same, and set out on our 1,000-mile journey. I had a stack of memos to read and a long list of calls to make. I had also Googled every NPR station from Westchester to Des Moines, all set for a long drive. In Maumee, we pulled into the parking lot of a strip mall off the highway for lunch. I ordered a chicken burrito bowl with a side of guacamole. Nick Merrill, my traveling press secretary, made fun of me for eating it out of the little cup with a spoon, bypassing the chips. Nobody in the restaurant thought it was remarkable that I was there. In fact, nobody recognized me. Bliss. But when members of the press found out, they reacted like a UFO had landed in Ohio and an extraterrestrial had wandered into a Chipotle. CNN ran grainy footage from the restaurant's security camera, which made it look a little like we were robbing a bank. The New York Times did an analysis that concluded my meal was healthier than the average Chipotle order, with fewer calories, saturated fat, and sodium. Good get for the Times. They really ate CNN's lunch on that one. The whole thing felt silly. To paraphrase an old saying, sometimes a burrito bowl is just a burrito bowl. Soon I was back in Iowa, the state that handed me a humbling third-place finish in 2008. Like the road trip, I wanted this first visit to be no frills. I would do more listening than talking, just as I had at the start of my first Senate campaign in New York. My new state director, Matt Paul, who knew Iowa inside and out after years of working for Governor Tom Vilsack and Senator Tom Harkin, agreed. Iowans wanted to get to know their candidates, not just listen to them give speeches. That's exactly what I wanted, too. When Donald Trump started his campaign, he seemed confident that he already had all the answers. He had no ideological core, apart from his towering self-regard, which blotted out all hope of learning or growing. As a result, he had no need to listen to anyone but himself. I approached things differently. After 4 years traveling the world as Secretary of State, I wanted to reconnect with the problems that were keeping American families up at night and hear directly about their hopes for the future. I had a core set of ideas and principles, but wanted to hear from voters to inform new plans to match what was really going on in their lives and the country. One of the first people I met in New Hampshire, another early contest state, provided a case in point. Pam was a grandmother in her 50s with gray hair and the air of someone who carries a lot of responsibility on her shoulders. She was an employee of a 111-year-old family-run furniture business I visited in Keene. We were talking about how to help small businesses grow, but Pam had a different challenge on her mind. Her daughter had gotten hooked on pain medication after giving birth to a baby boy, which led to a long struggle with drug addiction. Eventually, Child and Family Services started calling Pam, warning that her grandson could end up in foster care. So she and her husband, John, took the child in, and Pam found herself back in the role of primary caretaker she thought she had finished years before. Pam wasn't the complaining type. This was a labor of love, and she was glad to pick up the slack, especially now that her daughter was in treatment. But she was worried. A lot of families in town were facing similar struggles. In New Hampshire, more people were dying from drug overdoses than from car crashes. The number of people seeking treatment for heroin addiction had soared 90% over the past decade. For prescription drugs, the number was up 500%. I knew a little about this. At the time, Bill and I were friends with three families who had lost young adult children to opioids. Sadly, that number has now grown to 5. One was a charismatic young man who worked at the State Department while he was in law school. A friend of his offered some pills. He took them, went to sleep that night, and never woke up. Others took drugs after drinking, and their hearts stopped. After these tragedies, the Clinton Foundation partnered with Adapt Pharma to make available free doses of the opioid antidote naloxone, Narcan, which can save lives by helping prevent overdoses to every high school and college in the United States. On that first visit to New Hampshire in a coffee shop in downtown Keene, a retired doctor leaned in and asked, "What can you do about the opioid and heroin epidemic?" It was chilling to hear that word epidemic, but it was the right one. In 2015, more than 33,000 people died from overdosing on opioids. If you add to that the number from 2014, it's more Americans than were killed in the entire Vietnam War. Resources for treatment couldn't come close to keeping up. Parents liquidated their savings to pay for their kids' treatment. Some called the police about their own children because they had tried everything else. Yet despite all this, substance abuse wasn't getting much national attention either in Washington or in the national media. I didn't think about it as a campaign issue until I started hearing stories like Pam's in Iowa and New Hampshire. I called my policy team together and told them we had to get working right away on a strategy. My advisors fanned out. We held town hall meetings and heard more stories. In one session in New Hampshire, a substance abuse counselor asked anyone who had been impacted by the epidemic to raise his or her hand. Nearly every hand in the room went up. A woman in treatment told me, "We're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well." To help her and millions of others do that, we came up with a plan to expand access to treatment, improve training for doctors and pharmacists prescribing prescription drugs, reform the criminal justice system so more nonviolent drug offenders end up in rehab instead of prison, and make sure every first responder in America carries naloxone, which is close to a miracle drug. This became a model for how my campaign operated in those early months. People told me story after story about the challenges their families faced. Student debt, the high cost of prescription drugs and insurance premiums, and wages too low to support a middle-class life. I'd use those conversations to guide the policies already being hammered out back in our Brooklyn headquarters. I wanted my policy shop to be bold, innovative, industrious, and most importantly, responsive to people's real-life needs. Jake Sullivan, my director of policy planning at the State Department, Ann O'Leary, a longtime advisor of mine who shared my passion for children and healthcare policy, and Maya Harris, a veteran civil rights advocate, built and led a great team. You can compare this to how Trump operated. When the opioid epidemic finally started getting news attention, he jumped on it as a way of making people believe that America was falling apart. But once he became president, he turned his back on everyone who needed help by seeking to cut money for treatment. The press often seemed bored by the roundtables where these conversations happened. Critics dismissed them as staged or carefully controlled. But I wasn't bored. I wanted to talk with people, not at them. I also learned a lot. To me, this was a big part of what running for president was supposed to be. Over the long months that I had weighed running a second time, I thought a lot about what kind of campaign I'd want. I certainly wanted one different from the one I ran during my 2008 primary loss to Barack Obama. I studied what he did right and I did wrong. There was more to learn after 2012, when the president put together another strong campaign that helped him win re-election over Mitt Romney by a healthy margin despite a lackluster economy. His operations were two of the best ever. I paid attention. My low-profile first trip to Iowa reflected some of the lessons that I kept in mind as I started to put my own organization in place. In 2008, I had been criticized for arriving in Iowa like a queen, holding big rallies and acting like victory was inevitable. I never thought that was a fair description of me or our campaign. We believed I could prevail in a crowded and talented field, but we certainly didn't take Iowa for granted. In fact, we recognized that it wasn't an ideal first contest for me and spent a fair amount of 2007 trying to figure out how to make the best of it. Still, the criticism stuck, and I took it seriously. This time, I was determined to run like an underdog and avoid any whiff of entitlement. I also wanted to build on the best parts of my 2008 effort, especially the fighting spirit of our campaigns in Ohio and Pennsylvania, where I succeeded in forming a bond with working-class voters who felt invisible in George W. Bush's America. I had dedicated my victory in the Ohio primary to everyone who's ever been counted out but refused to be knocked out, for everyone who has stumbled but stood right back up, and for everyone who works hard and never gives up. I wanted to bring that spirit to the 2016 campaign, along with the best lessons of Obama's victories. We sought to set the right tone with my announcement video. It showed a series of Americans talking excitedly about new challenges they were taking on. Two brothers starting a small business, a mom getting her daughter ready for the first day of kindergarten, a college student applying for her first job, a couple getting married. Then I appeared briefly to say that I was running for president to help Americans get ahead and stay ahead, and that I was going to work hard to earn every vote. This campaign wasn't going to be about me and my ambitions. It would be about you and yours. There were other lessons to put into action. In 2008, the Obama campaign had been way ahead of us in using advanced data analytics to model the electorate, target voters, and test messages. It focused relentlessly on grassroots organizing and winning the delegates who would actually decide the nomination. It also built a no-drama campaign organization that largely avoided damaging infighting and leaks. John Podesta and I talked with President Obama and David Plouffe about how to construct a team that could replicate these successes. Plouffe was a big fan of Robbie Mook, whom I ultimately chose as campaign manager. Robbie had impressed David by helping me win against the odds and against him in Nevada, Ohio, and Indiana in 2008. In all three states, he put together aggressive field programs and competed hard for every vote. Then he went on to manage my friend Terry McAuliffe's successful long-shot campaign for governor of Virginia. Robbie was on a roll, young but, like Plouffe, highly disciplined and level-headed, with a passion for data and a talent for organizing. Huma Abedin, my trusted and valued advisor for years, would be campaign vice chair. President Obama praised his pollsters, Joel Benenson and John Anzalone, and focus group expert David Binder, so I hired all three, as well as a veteran of the Obama data analytics team, Elon Kriegel. Naveen Nayak came on board to coordinate all these different elements of opinion research. Here's how to keep it all straight. Pollsters call up a random sample of people and ask their opinions about candidates and issues. Focus groups gather a handful of people together in a room for an in-depth discussion that can last several hours. And data analytics teams make a lot of survey calls, crunch huge amounts of additional demographic, consumer, and polling data, and feed it all into complex models that try to predict how people will vote. These are all staples of modern campaigns. To help guide messaging and create ads, I hired Jim Margolis, a respected Obama veteran, and Mandy Grunwald, who had been with me and Bill since our first national campaign in 1992. They worked with Oren Schur, my director of paid media, and several talented and creative ad agencies. I thought Jim's and Mandy's partnership would represent the best of both worlds. That's what I was going for with all my hiring decisions. Mix the best available talent from the Obama campaigns with top-notch pros I knew already. The latter category included Dennis Chang, who had raised hundreds of millions of dollars for my 2006 Senate re-election campaign and 2008 presidential campaign, and later helped build up the Clinton Foundation endowment. Mignon Moore, one of the most experienced political operatives in Democratic politics and a veteran of my husband's White House, and Jose Villarreal, a business leader who had worked with me at State and came on board to serve as my campaign treasurer. As I built my team, I was focused on two tricky areas: how to strike the right balance with President Obama and his White House, and, drumroll for emphasis, how to improve my relationship with the press. The challenge of striking a balance with President Obama wasn't personal, after all. After 4 years in his cabinet, we liked and trusted each other. There aren't many people in the world who know what it's like to run for president or live in the White House, but we had that in common, and it gave us a special bond. When he finally passed health care reform, something I had fought for long and hard, I was overjoyed and gave him a big hug before a meeting in the White House Situation Room. After his rough first presidential debate with Mitt Romney in 2012, I tried to cheer him up with a photoshopped image of Big Bird strapped to Mitt's family car. Romney had promised to slash funding for PBS and also famously took road trips with his dog on the roof of his car. "Please take a look at the image below, smile, and then keep that smile near at hand," I told the president. "We'll get this done," he replied. "Just hold the world together 5 more weeks for me." Now that we had switched places and I was the candidate and he was the cheerleader, the challenge for me was navigating the tension between continuity and change. On the one hand, I believed deeply in what he had accomplished as president and desperately wanted to make sure a Republican wouldn't be able to undo it all. We might have areas of disagreement, such as on Syria, trade, and how to deal with an aggressive Russia, but by and large, I would defend his record, try to build on his accomplishments, and listen to his advice. He would call from time to time and share his thoughts on the race. "Don't try to be hip. You're a grandma," he'd tease. "Just be yourself and keep doing what you're doing." I was proud to have Barack's support and nearly every day told audiences around the country that he didn't get the credit he deserved for putting our country back together after the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. At the same time, there were big problems that still needed fixing in America. And part of my job as candidate was to make it clear that I saw them and was ready to take them on. Inevitably, that meant pointing out areas where the Obama administration's efforts had fallen short, even if the main culprit was Republican obstruction. It was a fine line to walk, as it would have been for Vice President Biden or anyone who had served in the Obama administration. If I failed to strike the right balance, I ran the risk of either seeming disloyal or being cast as the candidate of the status quo, both of which would be damaging. In one of the first meetings of our new team in a conference room on the 29th floor of a Midtown Manhattan office building, Joel Benenson presented the results of his early opinion research. He said Americans had two main pain points that would likely shape their views of the election: economic pressure and political gridlock. The economy was definitely in better shape than it had been after the financial crisis, but incomes hadn't begun to rise for most families, so people still felt like their progress was fragile and could be ripped away at any moment. And they had come to view dysfunction in Washington as a big part of the problem. They were right. I had seen that dysfunction firsthand and knew how hard it would be to break through it, although I think it's fair to say I underestimated how my opponents would wrongly accuse me of being responsible for a broken system. I had a record of success working with Republicans over the years. I had plans for aggressive campaign finance reform, which would remove some of the profit motive behind the gridlock, and I believed we had a strong shot at making progress. The problem remained: how to find a compelling way to talk about the pain Americans felt and their dissatisfaction with how things were going in the country without reinforcing Republican criticisms of the Obama administration, which would be self-defeating and just plain wrong. Joel said I was starting from a strong place. 55% of voters in the battleground states had a favorable view of me, compared with just 41% with an unfavorable view. Voters liked that I had worked for Obama after losing to him in 2008. They also thought it showed loyalty and patriotism. They thought I had done a good job as Secretary of State, and most believed I was ready to be president. But even though I'd been in the public eye for decades, they knew little about what I had actually done, much less why I had done it. This presented both a challenge and an opportunity. Despite having near universal name recognition, I would have to reintroduce myself. not as an extension of Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, but as an independent leader with my own story, values, and vision. There were also some warning signs to worry about. While my approval ratings were high, just 44% of voters said they trusted me to be their voice in Washington. That told us that some people respected me but weren't sure I was in it for them. I was determined to change that perception. The reason I had gotten into public service was to make life better for children and families, and now it was my job to make sure people understood that. There was something else we needed to do. Avoid repeating past problems with the political press corps. Over the years, my relationship with the political press had become a vicious cycle. The more they went after me, the more guarded I became, which only made them criticize me more. I knew that if I wanted 2016 to be different, I was going to have to try to change the dynamic and establish a more open and constructive give and take. There was some precedent. As a senator, I got along surprisingly well with the rough-and-tumble journalists of New York, and I grew downright fond of the State Department press corps, which consisted largely of journalists who had written about foreign policy for years. We talked easily, went out together on the road, toured Angkor Wat in Cambodia, dined in a Bedouin tent in Saudi Arabia, danced in South Africa, and had adventures all over the globe. For the most part, they covered me fairly, and when I felt they didn't, they were open to my criticism. Now I would try to establish a similar rapport with the political reporters covering the campaign. I knew they were under constant pressure to write stories that would drive clicks and retweets, and that negative stories sell. So I was skeptical, but it was worth a shot. To help me do it, I hired Jennifer Palmieri, a savvy professional with strong press relationships. Jennifer had worked for John Podesta in the Clinton White House and at the Democratic think tank, the Center for American Progress. Most recently, she had been President Obama's communications director in the White House. The president loved Jennifer, and so did I. I asked Christina Shockey, a former top aide to Michelle Obama, and later Christina Reynolds, who had worked on the John Edwards and Obama campaigns, to be her deputies. They were joined by National Press Secretary Brian Fallon, a graduate of the acclaimed Chuck Schumer School of Communications and a former spokesman for the Department of Justice, and Karen Finney, the former MSNBC host who had first worked for me in the White House. When Jennifer, Christine, and I sat down together for the first time, I let 2 decades worth of frustrations with the press pour out. "Buckle up," I said, "this is going to be a rough ride," but I was ready to try whatever they recommended to get off on a better foot this time. With my senior team coming together, we got to work building an organization that could go the distance. Presidential campaigns are like startups on steroids. You have to raise an enormous amount of money very quickly, hire a huge staff, deploy them across the country, and build a sophisticated data operation largely from scratch. As a candidate, you have to manage all that while maintaining a grueling campaign schedule that keeps you hundreds or thousands of miles from headquarters nearly every day. In 2008, I had a good, hardworking team, but I allowed internal rivalries to fester and didn't establish a clear chain of command until it was too late. Still, we came so close to winning. I vowed that this time we would do things differently. I was determined to have the best data, the most field organizers, the biggest fundraising network, and the deepest political relationships. I was thrilled that Beth Jones, a talented manager working at the White House, agreed to be campaign chief operating officer. To lead our organizing and outreach efforts, I turned to 3 political pros, Marlon Marshall, Bryn Craig, and Amanda Renteria. I also hired experienced organizers to run the key early states. In addition to Matt Paul in Iowa, there was Mike Vlasich, who had helped reelect my friend Senator Jeanne Shaheen in New Hampshire and led my efforts to beat Trump there in November. Emmy Ruiz, who helped lead us to victory in the Nevada caucus before moving to Colorado for the general and helping us win there too, and Clay Middleton, a longtime aide to Congressman Jim Clyburn, who helped us win a landslide victory in the South Carolina primary. To infuse the campaign with a spirit of innovation, we got advice from Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, and other top tech leaders, and hired engineers from Silicon Valley. Stephanie Hannon, an experienced engineer, became the first woman to serve as chief technology officer on a major presidential campaign. I hired one of President Obama's former aides, Teddy Goff, to handle all things digital, along with my longtime advisor, Katie Dowd, and Jenna Lowenstein from Emily's List. They had a tough job on their hands with a less-than-tech-savvy candidate, but I promised to be a good sport about every Facebook chat, TweetStorm, and Snapchat interview they recommended. To make sure we built the most diverse team ever assembled by a presidential campaign, I brought in Bernard Coleman as the first-ever chief diversity officer, made sure women were half the staff, and hired hundreds of people of color, including for senior leadership roles. We put our headquarters in Brooklyn, and the office soon teemed with idealistic, sleep-deprived 20-somethings. It felt like a cross between a tech startup and a college dorm. I've been a part of a lot of campaigns going all the way back to 1968, and this was the most collegial and collaborative I've ever seen. So, how did it go? Well, we didn't win. But I can say with zero equivocation that my team made me enormously proud. They built a fantastic organization in the early states and helped me win the Iowa caucus despite tough demographics, as well as the Nevada caucus and the South Carolina primary. In the general election, they recruited 50,000 more volunteers than the 2012 Obama campaign did, and contacted voters 5 million more times. My team absorbed one gut punch after another and never gave up, never turned on one another, and never stopped believing in our cause. That doesn't mean there weren't disagreements and debates over a wide range of questions. Of course there were. It was a campaign, for heaven's sake. But even on the night of our landslide defeat in the New Hampshire primary, or during the worst days of the email controversy, nobody buckled. And have I mentioned that we went on to win the national popular vote by nearly 3 million? It was a terrific group of people. And I'm not just talking about the senior leadership. All the young men and women crowded around desks at headquarters in Brooklyn working impossible hours. All the field organizers who were the heart and soul of the campaign. All the advanced staff who lived out of suitcases for 2 years, organizing and staging events across the country, volunteers of every age and background. More Americans volunteered more time for the 2016 campaign than for any campaign in U.S. history. My team was full of dedicated people who left families and friends to move someplace new, knock on doors, make phone calls, recruit volunteers, and persuade voters. They worked intensely while juggling relationships, welcoming newborn babies, and handling other family obligations. Two of my young communications aides, Jesse Ferguson and Tyrone Gale, kept working through difficult cancer treatments, never losing their devotion to the campaign or their senses of humor. Some of my favorite moments out on the trail were when a volunteer would come up to me as I shook hands on a rope line after a rally. They'd whisper in my ear about what a great job our local organizer was doing, or how welcoming our staff was to people who wanted to help, and how their enthusiasm was infectious. That always made my day. The fact that so many of these young people have decided to stay in politics and keep up the fight despite our loss makes me very happy and proud. Having said all that, of course the campaign didn't go as planned. I ended up falling into many of the pitfalls I had worried about and tried to avoid from the start. Some of that was my own doing, but a lot of it was due to forces beyond my control. Despite my intention to run like a scrappy challenger, I became the inevitable front runner before I shook my first hand or gave my first speech, just by virtue of sky-high expectations. The controversy over my emails quickly cast a shadow over our efforts and threw us into a defensive crouch from which we never fully recovered. You can hear plenty more about that later in this book. But suffice to say that one boneheaded mistake turned into a campaign-defining and destroying scandal thanks to a toxic mix of partisan opportunism, interagency turf battles, a rash FBI director, my own inability to explain the whole mess in a way people could understand, and media coverage that by its very volume told the voters this was by far the most important issue of the campaign. Most people couldn't explain what it was really all about or how the allegations that I was a threat to national security squared with the support I had from respected military and civilian national security experts, including Republicans and independents, but they understandably came away with the impression I had done a big, bad thing. One result was that right away, I was back in my usual adversarial relationship with the press, clamming up and trying to avoid gotcha interviews at a time when I needed to be reintroducing myself to the country. I watched my approval numbers drop and my disapproval and distrust numbers rise, as my message about all the things I wanted to do as president was blocked or overwhelmed. There were other disappointments as well. In 2008, critics had slammed me for not being accessible to voters and avoiding traditional grip-and-grin campaigning. This time, they went the other way and ridiculed my intimate listening sessions. "Where are the rallies? Why can't she draw a crowd?" they'd ask. That enthusiasm question never really went away, even when we drew large crowds. Other than Iowa and Nevada, where we built extensive organizations, I struggled in caucuses just as I had the last time. By their structure and rules, caucuses favor the most committed activists who are willing to spend long hours waiting to be counted. That gave the advantage to the insurgent left-wing candidacy of Bernie Sanders. My advantage came in primaries, which have secret ballots and all-day voting, like a typical election, and much higher turnout. The difference was most clear in Washington State, which held both a caucus and a primary. Bernie won the caucus in March, and I won the primary in May, in which three times as many people voted. Unfortunately, most of the delegates were awarded based on the caucus. Ultimately, none of this mattered much after I built up a large delegate lead in March. What did matter and had a lasting impact was that Bernie's presence in the race meant that I had less space and credibility to run the kind of feisty progressive campaign that had helped me win Ohio and Pennsylvania in 2008. One piece of advice that President Obama gave me throughout the campaign was that we needed more message discipline, and he was right. In 1992, Bill relied on James Carville and Paul Begala to help him shape his winning message, and they made sure that everyone in the campaign, including the candidate, stuck to it day after day after day. In 2016, my campaign was blessed with many brilliant strategists, and they helped me develop a message stronger together that reflected my values and vision and a clear contrast with Trump. It may not have been catchy enough to break through the wall of negative coverage about emails, maybe nothing could, but it was the case I wanted to make. And when voters got a chance to hear from me directly at the convention and in the debates, polls showed they liked what they heard. It's true, though, that we struggled to stay on message. My advisors had to deal with a candidate, me, who often wanted something new to say as opposed to just repeating the same stump speech over and over. In addition, more than in any race I can remember, we were constantly buffeted by events, from the email controversy to WikiLeaks to mass shootings and terrorist attacks. There was no such thing as a normal day, and the press didn't cover normal campaign speeches. What they were interested in was a steady diet of conflict and scandal. As a result, when it came to driving a consistent message, we were fighting an uphill battle. Add all this together, and I think you get a picture of a campaign that had both great strengths and real weaknesses, just like every campaign in history. There are important lessons to learn from what we got right and what we got wrong. But I totally reject the notion that it was an unusually flawed or dysfunctional campaign. That's just wrong. My team battled serious headwinds to win the popular vote, and if not for the dramatic intervention of the FBI director in the final days, I believe that in spite of everything, we would have won the White House. I've been criticized harshly by political pundits for saying that, and even some of my supporters have said they agree with me, but I shouldn't say it. If you feel this way, I hope you'll keep going and give my response a fair hearing. Since the election, I've asked myself many times if I learned the wrong lessons from 2008. Was I fighting the previous war when I should have been focused on how much our politics had changed? Much has been made about my campaign's supposed over-reliance on Obama-style big data at the expense of more traditional political gut instinct and trusting folks on the ground. This is another criticism I reject. It's true that some of our models were off, just like everyone else's, including the media, the Trump campaign, everyone. Probably because some Trump supporters refused to talk to pollsters or weren't honest about their preferences or because people changed their minds. It's also true that like any large organization, we could have done a better job listening to the anecdotal feedback we were getting from folks on the ground. It's not like we didn't try. My team was constantly in touch with local leaders, and I had trusted friends reporting back to me from all over the country, including a big group of Arkansans, the Arkansas Travelers, who fanned out in nearly every state. I believe they helped us win the razor-close Missouri primary, and they were a constant source of information and perspective for me. But every precinct leader and party chair in the country wants more attention and resources. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. You can't make those decisions blind. You have to be guided by the best data available. This isn't an either-or choice. You need both data and good old-fashioned political instinct. I'm convinced that the answer for Democrats going forward is not to abandon data, but to obtain better data. Use it more effectively, question every assumption, and keep adapting. And we need to listen carefully to what people are telling you and try to assess that too. Still, in terms of fighting the previous war, I think it's fair to say that I didn't realize how quickly the ground was shifting under all our feet. This was the first election where the Supreme Court's disastrous 2010 Citizens United decision allowing unlimited political donations was in full force, but the Voting Rights Act of 1965 wasn't, because of another terrible decision by the court in 2013. I was running a traditional presidential campaign with carefully thought-out policies and painstakingly built coalitions, while Trump was running a reality TV show that expertly and relentlessly stoked Americans' anger and resentment. I was giving speeches laying out how to solve the country's problems. He was ranting on Twitter. Democrats were playing by the rules and trying too hard not to offend the press. Republicans were chucking the rule book out the window and working the refs as hard as they could. I may have won millions more votes, but he's the one sitting in the Oval Office. Both the promise and the perils of my campaign came together on a warm and brilliantly sunny June day in 2015, when I formally announced my candidacy in a speech to thousands of supporters on Roosevelt Island in New York's East River. Now the event seems almost like a quaint throwback to an earlier era of politics, a time when policies and polish were assets, not liabilities. Nonetheless, that hopeful, joyous day on Roosevelt Island will always rank as one of my favorites. For weeks before the speech, I went back and forth with my team about what to say and how to say it. I've never been very adept at summing up my entire life story, worldview, and agenda in pithy soundbites. I was also acutely aware that as the first woman to be a credible candidate for president, I looked and sounded different than any presidential candidate in our country's history. I had no precedent to follow, and voters had no historical frame of reference to draw upon. It was exhilarating to enter uncharted territory, but uncharted, by definition, means uncertain. If I felt that way, I was sure that a lot of voters would feel even more wary about it. I also knew that despite being the first woman to have a serious chance at the White House, I was unlikely to be seen as a transformative, revolutionary figure. I had been on the national stage too long for that, and my temperament was too even-keeled. Instead, I hoped that my candidacy and, if things worked out, my presidency would be viewed as the next chapter in the long progressive struggle to make the country fairer, freer, and stronger, and to beat back a seriously scary right-wing agenda. This framing took me directly into the politically dangerous territory of seeking a so-called third term after Obama and being seen as the candidate of continuity instead of change. But it was honest. And I thought placing my candidacy in the grand tradition of my progressive forebears would help voters accept and embrace the unprecedented nature of my campaign. So when Huma suggested launching the campaign on Roosevelt Island named after Franklin Delano, I knew it was the right choice. I'm something of a Roosevelt buff. First on the list will always be Eleanor. She was a crusading first lady and progressive activist who never stopped speaking her mind and didn't give a damn what people thought. I return to her aphorisms again and again. If I feel depressed, I go to work. A woman is like a teabag. You never know how strong she is until she's in hot water. There was a minor Washington tempest back in the 1990s when a newspaper claimed I was having seances in the White House to commune directly with Eleanor's spirit. I wasn't, though it would have been nice to talk to her now and then. I'm also fascinated by Eleanor's husband, Franklin, and her uncle, Teddy. I was riveted by Ken Burns's 7-part documentary about all three Roosevelts that aired on PBS in 2014. I was particularly struck by the parallels between what Teddy faced as president in the early years of the 20th century as the Industrial Revolution upended American society and what we faced in the early years of the 21st century. In both eras, disruptive technological change, massive income inequality, and excessive corporate power created a social and political crisis. Teddy responded by breaking up powerful monopolies, passing laws to protect working people, and safeguarding the environment. He may have been a Republican, but he put the capital P in progressive. He was also a shrewd politician who managed to fend off the demands of angry populists on his left who wanted to go even further towards socialism and conservatives on his right who would have let the robber barons amass even more wealth and power. Teddy found the right balance and called it the square deal. I love that phrase. And the more I thought about the challenges facing America in the years following the financial crisis of 2008-2009, the more I felt that what we needed was another square deal. We needed to regain our balance, take on the forces that had crashed our economy, and protect hardworking families shortchanged by automation, globalization, and inequality. We needed the political skill to restrain unchecked greed while diffusing the most destructive impulses of resurgent populism. On tough days out on the road, when reading the news felt like getting your teeth kicked in, I'd remember what Teddy said about those of us who climb into the arena. "It is not the critic who counts," he said, "but the competitor, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly." I also was inspired by Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal program of the 1930s, which saved capitalism from itself following the Great Depression, and by his vision of a humane, progressive, internationalist America. Four Freedoms Park at the tree-lined tip of Roosevelt Island commemorates the universal freedoms FDR proclaimed during World War II, freedom of speech and worship, freedom from want and fear. It's a picturesque spot with a striking view of the New York skyline. Announcing my candidacy there felt right. The final few days were a flurry of marking up drafts and rewriting lines with Dan Schwerin, my longtime speechwriter who had been with me since the Senate. As the campaign went on, he would be joined by Megan Rooney, a wonderful writer who spent 4 years traveling the world with me at State and then went to the White House to write for President Obama. Despite our best efforts, when the morning of June 13th dawned, I was still not quite satisfied. I turned to the bottom of page 4. The key moment in the speech when I was supposed to say, "That's why I'm running for president." What followed, "to make our economy work for you and for every American," was true and important. It was the result of deliberation and debate with my senior advisors, culminating a few days before around the table in my dining room in Washington. I had put down a draft in frustration, declared myself finished with all the slogans and sound bites, and said that I was really running for president to make the economy work for everyone, and why didn't we just say that and be done with it? But something was missing, emotional lift, a sense that we were setting out on a common mission to secure our shared destiny. I remembered a note that Dan and I had received a few days earlier from Jim Kennedy, a great friend who has a deft way with words. He reflected on a line from Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech. Our strength is our unity of purpose. America is a family, Jim noted, and we should have one another's backs. In that moment, I had no idea that the election would turn into a contest between the divisiveness of Donald Trump and my vision of an America that's stronger together. But it felt right to call for shared purpose, to remind Americans that there is much more that unites us than divides us. I picked up my ballpoint pen and, playing off Jim's language, wrote, "We Americans may differ, bicker, stumble, and fall, but we are at our best when we pick each other up, when we have each other's back. Like any family, our American family is strongest when we cherish what we have in common and fight back against those who would drive us apart." A few hours later, I was standing at the podium in the blinding sun, looking out at the excited faces of cheering supporters. I saw little kids perched on their parents' shoulders. Friends smiled up at me from the front row. Bill, Chelsea, and Mark were glowing with pride and love. The stage was shaped like our campaign logo, a big blue H with a red arrow cutting across the middle. All around it, a sea of people clapped, hollered, and waved American flags. I allowed myself a moment to think, this is really happening. I am going to run for president, and I am going to win. Then I started to speak. It was hard to read the teleprompter with the sun in my eyes, but I knew the words well by this point. It was a long speech, full of policies and insights developed over the previous months of listening to people such as Pam in New Hampshire. That's not everyone's cup of tea, but I thought it was the kind of speech a candidate for the most important job in the world ought to give. Serious, substantive, honest about the challenges ahead, and hopeful about our ability to meet them. I told a couple jokes. "I may not be the youngest candidate in this race," I said, "but I will be the youngest woman president in the history of the United States." Little did I know that, in fact, I would end up being the youngest candidate, running against septuagenarians Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. I was pleased with how the speech was received. The journalist, John Allen, who has followed me over the years, declared, "Clinton pretty much nailed the vision thing." Jared Bernstein, Joe Biden's former top economic advisor, smartly described it as a reconnection agenda. I loved that. That aimed to reunite economic growth with the prosperity of middle and low-income families. But it was E.J. Dion, one of my favorite political commentators, who had the most thought-provoking and, in retrospect, haunting reaction. "Hillary Clinton is making a bet and issuing a challenge. The bet is that voters will pay more attention to what she can do for them than to what her opponents will say about her," EJ wrote. "The challenge is to her Republican adversaries. Can they go beyond low-tax, anti-government bromides to make credible counteroffers to the nurses, truckers, factory workers, and food servers whom Clinton made the heroes of her Roosevelt Island narrative about grace under pressure?" We know now that I lost that bet, not because a Republican came along and made a more credible counteroffer to middle-class voters, but because Donald Trump did something else, appeal to the ugliest impulses of our national character. He also made false promises about being on the side of working people. As Michael Bloomberg later said at the Democratic National Convention, "I'm a New Yorker, and I know a con when I see one." Me too. As I would often do in big moments over the course of the campaign, I closed the speech by talking about my mother, Dorothy, who passed away in 2011. She lived to be 92 years old, and I often thought about all the progress she witnessed over the course of her long life. Progress won because generations of Americans kept fighting for what they knew to be right. "I wish my mother could have been with us longer," I said. "I wish she could have seen Chelsea become a mother herself. I wish she could have met Charlotte. I wish she could have seen the America we're going to build together." I looked out at the crowd and up at the New York skyline across the water, smiled, and said, "An America where a father can tell his daughter, yes, you can be anything you want to be, even President of the United States." Time is the coin of your life. You spend it. Do not allow others to spend it for you. Carl Sandburg. A Day in the Life. A presidential campaign is a marathon run at the pace of a sprint. Every day, every hour, every moment counts. But there are so many days, nearly 600 in the case of the 2015-2016 campaign, that you have to be careful not to burn out before hitting the finish line. President Obama drilled this point home when I was getting ready to run. He reminded me that when we faced off in 2008, we would often end up staying at the same hotel in Iowa or New Hampshire. He said his team would be finished with dinner and getting ready to call it a night when we finally got there, completely spent. By the time he woke up the next morning, we'd be long gone. In short, he thought we overdid it. "Hillary," he said, "you've got to pace yourself this time. Work smart, not just hard." Whenever we saw each other, he'd say it again, and he'd tell John and Huma to remind me. I tried to follow his advice. After all, he won twice. My approach came down to two words, routine and joy. At the beginning, I put some routines in place to keep my traveling team and me as healthy and productive as possible through one of the hardest things any of us would ever do. And we all tried our best to savor every moment that came our way, to find joy and meaning in the daily grind of campaigning. Not a day went by when we didn't. Since the election, my life and routine have changed greatly, but I still treasure many moments from that long and sometimes strange trip. Many mental snapshots that I took along the way are in this chapter. So are a lot of details about a typical day on the trail, what I ate, who did my hair and makeup, what my mornings were like. It may seem strange, but I get asked about these things constantly. Philippe Reines, my longtime advisor who played Trump in our debate prep sessions, has my favorite explanation why. He calls it the panda principle. Pandas just live their lives. They eat bamboo. They play with their kids. But for some reason, people love watching pandas, hoping for something, anything to happen. When that one baby panda sneezed, the video became a viral sensation. Under Philippe's theory, I'm like a panda. A lot of people just want to see how I live. And I do love spending time with my family and getting some sun, just like a panda. And while I'm not into bamboo, I like to eat. I get it. We want to know our leaders, and part of that is hearing about Ronald Reagan's jelly bean habit and Madeleine Albright's pin collection. In that spirit, if you've ever wondered what a day in the life of a presidential candidate is like, or if you've ever asked yourself, does Hillary Clinton just eat lunch like a normal person? This is for you. 6 a.m., I wake up, sometimes hitting the snooze button to steal a few more minutes. Snoozing leaves you more tired. There are studies on this. But in that moment, it seems like such a great idea. As often as we can, we arrange my schedule so I can sleep in my own bed in Chappaqua. Many nights, that isn't possible, and I wake up in a hotel room somewhere. That's okay. I can sleep anywhere. It's not unusual for me to sleep through a bumpy plane landing, but waking up at home is the best. Bill and I bought our home in 1999 because we loved the bedroom. It's 1.5 stories high with a vaulted ceiling and windows on three sides. When we first saw it as prospective homebuyers, Bill said that we would always wake up happy here, with the light streaming in and the view of the garden around us. He was right. There's a colorful portrait of Chelsea in her late teens on one wall of our bedroom, and photos of family and friends scattered everywhere. We love the wallpaper in our bedroom in the White House, yellow with pastel flowers, so I tracked it down for this bedroom, too. There are stacks of books on our bedside tables that we are reading or hoping to read soon. For years, we've been keeping careful track of everything we read. Plus, Bill being Bill, he has a rating system. The best books get 3 stars. After waking up, I check my email and read my morning devotional from Reverend Bill Shalady, which is usually waiting in my inbox. I spend a few minutes in contemplation organizing my thoughts and setting my priorities for the day. Then it's time for breakfast. When I'm home, I head downstairs. On the road, I order room service. It's hard to plan exactly what or when I'll be eating over the course of the day, since we're always on the go, so breakfast is key. Usually, I opt for scrambled egg whites with vegetables. When they're around, I add fresh jalapenos. Otherwise, it's salsa and hot sauce. I'm a black coffee and strong black tea person, and I drink a huge glass of water in the morning and keep drinking water all day long, since I fly a lot, which can be dehydrating. Over breakfast, I start reading the stack of press clips and briefing papers that have arrived overnight from my staff. If I'm home, Oscar Flores, a Navy veteran who had worked in the White House and is now our residence manager, prints it all out for me. I also take another look at the day's schedule, which is a logistical masterpiece. My team, Lona Valmoro, my invaluable scheduler since my Senate days, who also worked with me at the State Department, Alex Hornbrook, Director of Scheduling, who previously did the same job for Vice President Biden, and Jason Chung, Director of Advance, are miracle workers. They juggle dates and places with grace and create flawless events out of thin air. It isn't unusual to call them from the plane as we are landing at night to say, we need to completely redo tomorrow's schedule to add 1 more state and 2 more events. Their answer is always, no problem. If Bill's in town, he's probably still asleep. He's a night owl. I'm an early bird. But sometimes he'll get up with me and we'll read the papers. We get 4, the New York Times, the New York Daily News, the New York Post, and the Journal News, our local paper, and drink our coffee and talk about what we have going on that day. It's probably a lot like what's happening at that moment in our neighbors' houses, except in our case, one of us is running for president and the other one used to be president. I try to find time for yoga or a strength and cardio workout. At home, I work out in an old red barn out back that we've converted into a gym and an office for Bill, with space in the converted hayloft for the Secret Service. I'm no match for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, however, who pumps iron and does planks and push-ups 2 days a week. Her regimen is daunting. Mine is more forgiving. But if she can find the time and energy to exercise regularly, so can I. And you. When I'm on the road, I have a mini-exercise routine I've now done in hotel rooms across America. Then there's hair and makeup. Long ago, in a galaxy far, far away, having my hair and makeup done was a special treat every now and again. But having to do it every single day takes the fun out of it. Luckily, I have a glam squad that makes it easy. 2 hairdressers have taken great care of me in New York for years. John Barrett, whose full-service salon is in Manhattan, and Santa Nichols, whose cozy salon is just a few minutes from my house in Chappaqua. They're both terrific, though a lot of people were baffled to discover after my emails were made public that I had regular appointments with Santa. When I'm in New York and need help with my makeup, I see Melissa Silver, recommended to me by Vogue's Anna Wintour, after she saw me at an event and knew I needed help. On the campaign trail, I have a traveling team, Isabel Goetz and Barbara Lacey. Isabel is French and full of positivity. She doesn't walk so much as bop. She's been doing my hair on and off since the mid-1990s, which means we've been together through a lot of hairstyles. Barbara, like Isabel, is perpetually cheerful. In addition to doing my makeup on the campaign, she does makeup for movies and TV shows such as Veep. I, of course, don't want to be compared to Selena Meyer in any way, shape, or form, but there's no denying Julia Louis-Dreyfus looks fantastic. While they get me ready, I'm usually on the phone or reading my briefings for the day. That hour is valuable, so I occasionally schedule calls with staff to discuss electoral strategy or a new policy. They usually don't mind speaking over the blow dryer. Isabel and Barbara do their best to work around me until they tell me they need me to be still, s'il vous plaît. At the beginning of the campaign, Isabel and Barbara got me ready for the day once a week or so, as well as for big events such as debates. I tried to take care of my own hair and makeup the rest of the time. But photos don't lie, and since I looked better when they were with me, it became an everyday thing. When they travel with me, Isabel and Barbara are always nearby, ready to touch me up before interviews or debates. Every time our plane lands, Isabel rushes forward with hairspray, and Barbara spritzes my face with a vaporizer full of mineral water. The air on planes is so dry, she laments. Then she spritzes everyone else in the vicinity, including, at times, the Secret Service. I appreciate their talents and like how they make me look, but I've never gotten used to how much effort it takes just to be a woman in the public eye. I once calculated how many hours I spent having my hair and makeup done during the campaign. It came to about 600 hours, or 25 days. I was so shocked, I checked the math twice. I'm not jealous of my male colleagues often, but I am when it comes to how they can just shower, shave, put on a suit, and be ready to go. The few times I've gone out in public without makeup, it's made the news. So I sigh and keep getting back in that chair and dream of a future in which women in the public eye don't need to wear makeup if they don't want to, and no one cares either way. After hair and makeup, it's time to get dressed. When I ran for Senate in 2000 and president in 2008, I basically had a uniform, a simple pantsuit, often black, with a colorful shell underneath. I did this because I like pantsuits. They make me feel professional and ready to go. Plus, they helped me avoid the peril of being photographed up my skirt while sitting on a stage or climbing stairs, both of which happened to me as First Lady. After that, I took a cue from one of my childhood heroes, Nancy Drew, who would often do her detective work in sensible trousers. "I'm glad I wore pants," she said, in the clue of the tapping heels, after hoisting herself up on the rafters of a building in pursuit of a rare cat. I also thought it would be good to do what male politicians do, and wear more or less the same thing every day. As a woman running for president, I liked the visual cue that I was different from the men, but also familiar. A uniform was also an anti-distraction technique. Since there wasn't much to say or report on what I wore, maybe people would focus on what I was saying instead. In 2016, I wanted to dress the same as I did when I wasn't running for president and not overthink it. I was lucky to have something few others do, relationships with American designers who helped me find outfits I could wear from place to place in all climates. Ralph Lauren's team made the white suit I wore to accept the nomination and the red, white, and blue suits I wore to debate Trump three times. More than a dozen American designers made T-shirts to support my campaign and even held an event during New York Fashion Week to show them off. Some people like my clothes and some people don't. It goes with the territory. You can't please everybody, so you may as well wear what works for you. That's my theory, anyway. When I leave for several days on the road, I try to be super organized, but inevitably I overpack. I throw in more outfits than I need just in case the weather changes or something spills on me or an eager fan leaves makeup on my shoulder after an exuberant hug. Huma, someone who knows a thing or two about being stylish while working 20-hour days, tries to advise me. She's the one who will tell me I have on two different earrings, which happened a few times. I also overdo it on reading material. For a while, I filled an entire rolling suitcase with briefing memos and policy papers. Oscar helps me load everything into the cars. Sometimes Bill, marveling at all the stuff I'm bringing, asks, "Are you running away from home?" When the cars are loaded, the husband is hugged, and the dogs are cuddled, we're off. We fly in and out of Westchester County Airport, just a short drive from our house. I make a policy of trying not to be wheels up before 8:30 a.m. on the nights I sleep at home. Everyone on my team has at least an hour's drive home after we land in Westchester, and we often land late. An 8:30 a.m. start time means everyone gets at least some sleep. For the primaries and the beginning of the general election, my traveling team was small. It consisted of Huma, Nick Merrill, trip director Conley Keir, Sierra Koss, Julie Zuckerbrod, and Barbara Kinney, who videotaped and photographed life on the trail, and my Secret Service detail, which was usually two agents, sometimes three. A rotating cast of additional staff joined depending on what was happening that day. Speechwriters, members of the policy team, state organizers. By the end of the campaign, the team was much bigger, and so was the plane. A note about the Secret Service. Bill and I have been under Secret Service protection since 1992, as soon as he secured the Democratic nomination for president. It took some getting used to, but after 25 years, it feels normal. And to their great credit, the agents bend over backward to be as unobtrusive as possible. They are somehow both low-key and ferociously vigilant. The agents are with us at our home all day, every day. When I leave the house to do something casual around town, like go to the market or take a walk, agents come with me. They hang back and give me space to do whatever I'm doing. Sometimes I forget that they're there, which is exactly what they want. I'm grateful for the relationships we've built with many of these dedicated men and women over the years. We've also gotten to spend time with their spouses and children at the holiday party Bill and I host for our agents and their families every year, and I've met some of their extended families out on the campaign trail, too. When Bill and I travel, whether into Manhattan to see a play or all the way to Nevada for campaign events, the Secret Service kicks into higher gear. They coordinate ahead of time to make sure they know the details of every place we'll visit, all the entrances and exits, the fastest traffic routes, and just in case, backup routes and the nearest hospitals. They organize the motorcade, run background checks, and work with local police at every stop. It's an enormous undertaking, and they do it seamlessly. The only part of this I have a hard time with is the size of the motorcade. I understand why it's necessary, but it drives me crazy to see people sitting in traffic that I've caused. This feels especially problematic when I'm campaigning. Shutting down highways seems like the quickest way to make people resent me, which was the exact opposite of what I wanted to do. So I always ask the lead agent to avoid using lights and sirens whenever possible. I'm also embarrassed to admit that I do a fair amount of backseat driving. That's pretty rich coming from someone who hasn't driven a car regularly in 25 years. Luckily, the agents are too polite to tell me to put a sock in it. On a typical day on the trail after leaving the house, our motorcade of two or three cars pulls up right to the plane on the tarmac. Door-to-door service is both a security must and an extremely nice perk. For the primaries and the beginning of the general, we flew in planes with 9 or 10 seats. The traveling press had a plane of their own, which took extra coordination. Eventually, we chartered a Boeing 737 for the general election, big enough for all of us, with Stronger Together painted on the side and H logos on the tip of each wing. The plane was our home away from home for months. For the most part, it served us well. Of course, there were occasional hiccups. One day we were in Little Rock and had to get to Dallas. The plane had a mechanical issue, so they sent another one. While we were waiting on the tarmac, my staff got off the plane to stretch their legs. I decided to close my eyes after a grueling few days. I woke up a few hours later and asked, "Are we there already?" In fact, we hadn't moved. At a certain point in a long campaign, all sense of time and space disappears. Over the course of the campaign, we were joined by a number of flight attendants. They were all excellent, but my favorite was Elizabeth Rivalsi. She's a trained nutritionist and made fresh, delicious food for us in her kitchen in Queens, which she then packed into containers and brought on the plane. Salmon salad, chicken tenders made with almond flour, poblano pepper soup. Her surprise smash hit was brownies made out of chickpea flour. She also had a big basket full of snacks that she regularly replenishes with different items. It was a little adventure every time we boarded and checked out the stash. I have a weakness for Pepperidge Farm Goldfish crackers, and was delighted to find out that 55 goldfish were only 150 calories. Not bad. One time Liz brought something I hadn't tried before, flavor blasted goldfish. We passed around the bag and discussed whether it was better than the original. Some of my staff thought yes, which was incorrect. As you can tell, we took eating seriously. Someone once asked us what we talked about on long flights. Food, we chorused. It's funny how much you look forward to the next meal when you're living out of a suitcase. In 2008, we often relied on junk food to see us through. I remember a lot of pizza with sliced jalapenos delivered right to the plane. This time, I was determined that we would all be healthier. I asked friends for good on-the-go snack recommendations. A few days later, shipments of canned salmon as well as Quest and Kind protein bars arrived at my house, which we lugged onto the plane in canvas totes. When the Quest bars got cold, they were too hard to eat, so we sat on them for a few minutes to warm them up, with as much dignity as one can muster at such a moment. I also splurge every now and again on burgers and fries and enjoy every bite. Several of us put hot sauce on everything. I've been a fan since 1992 when I became convinced it boosted my immune system, as research now shows that it does. We were always on the lookout for new concoctions. One favorite is called Ninja Squirrel Sriracha. Julie, the videographer, came back from vacation in Belize with four little bottles of the best hot sauce any of us have ever had, Marie Sharp's. We immediately loved the red habanero pepper flavor the most. Everyone quietly jockeyed for that bottle, then handed it over sheepishly when confronted. Eventually, we realized we could just order more, and peace returned. Then there was the food we ate all over the country. We had a few favorite spots. A Middle Eastern takeout place in Detroit. A Cuban restaurant by the airport in Miami. Lattes made with honey and lavender from a bakery in Des Moines. At the Iowa State Fair in the 100-degree August heat, I drank about a gallon of lemonade. Nick handed me a pork chop on a stick, which I devoured. When we got back to the plane, I told him, I want you to know that I did not eat that pork chop on a stick because it is politically necessary. I ate that pork chop on a stick because it was delicious. He just nodded wordlessly and kept eating his own State Fair discovery, red velvet funnel cake. One hot night in Omaha, Nebraska, I was consumed with the desire for an ice cream bar, the simple kind, just vanilla ice cream with a chocolate shell. Connolly called an advanced staffer who kindly picked some up from the drugstore and met us at the plane on our way out of town. We said thank you and devoured them before they could melt. One of my favorite places to eat and drink is the hotel at Kirkwood Center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It's run by hospitality and culinary students from Kirkwood Community College, and they do a great job. On one of our first visits, I ordered a vodka martini with olives as cold as they could make it. Cecile Richards, the indomitable leader of Planned Parenthood and a Texan, was with me, and she insisted I try it with Tito's Handmade Vodka, the pride of Austin. It was a great drink. After that, whenever we stay at Kirkwood, the waiter sends over an ice-cold Tito's martini with olives without me even having to order it. We take birthdays and holidays seriously on the road. We put up decorations on board for Halloween and Christmas, and there's always a supply of birthday cakes on hand. We can't light candles, no fire allowed on the plane, so we tell the birthday boy or girl to pretend that they're lit and make a wish. We even found an iPhone app that simulates a lighter to take the game further, which we also use to light the menorah we had on board during Hanukkah. I am famously hard to surprise on my birthday, but for 2016, my team managed to sneak a cake into my hotel suite in Miami and gather silently in the living room while I was on the phone in the bedroom. When I walked out, they both startled and delighted me with an enthusiastic rendition of Happy Birthday and a chocolate cake with turquoise frosting. Since it was still early in the morning, we brought the cake with us on the plane to eat later. The night before, we had all celebrated together with an Adele concert. perfect. My team and I lived a lot of life together during our year and a half on the road. Families changed, babies were born, beloved friends and family passed away. Some people got engaged, some got separated. We raised a glass when Lorella Pirelli, our director of Latino outreach, took the oath to become an American citizen. Several of us traveled to New Haven, Connecticut a few weeks after the campaign began to hit the dance floor at Jake Sullivan's wedding to Maggie Goodlander. We were often away from home, under the gun, pushing ourselves as hard as we could to win. As a result, we relied on one another. We came to know one another's habits and preferences. We'd often gather in my room in the evenings to order room service and talk about that day's news coverage or go over the next day's schedule. We watched the Olympics together and the Republican debates. Both inspired yelling, though of different kinds. We could be impatient with one another, frustrated, exhausted, demoralized, but we also made one another laugh, broke hard news gently, kept our wits about us, and always stayed focused on the road ahead. It was grueling. Sometimes it wasn't fun at all, but it was also wonderful. Every day on the trail was packed with events. Rallies, roundtables, interviews, fundraisers, OTRs, off the records or unannounced visits to shops, parks, libraries, schools, hospitals, really anywhere. When we landed in a city, we'd jump from event to event. Sometimes our drive time would stretch to an hour or more. To make the most of it, we would schedule radio interviews back to back. I'd also FaceTime with Charlotte, who was now old enough to kind of have a conversation with me. I'd cheer as she spun around in her tutu. We'd sing songs together. Then I'd blow kisses, hang up, and head off to another event. Rallies are a whole other world. It's thrilling to hear a crowd cheer for you. It's thrilling to hear them cheer for your ideas. But I'll admit that no matter how many times I've stood before large crowds, it's always a little daunting. Our rallies were diverse, boisterous, and happy. The kind of place you could bring your 100-year-old mother or your 1-year-old son. I loved seeing all the homemade posters kids would wave while smiling ear to ear. One of the best things about our campaign logo, the H with the arrow, was that anyone can draw it, even little kids. We wanted children to spread out poster boards on their kitchen tables, grab markers and glitter pens, and go to town. They sent a lot of homemade H art to our campaign headquarters. We covered the walls with it. For the music at our rallies, we chose a lot of empowering women artists. Sarah Bareilles, Andra Day, Jennifer Lopez, Katy Perry, and Rachel Platten, as well as songs from Mark Anthony, Stevie Wonder, Pharrell Williams, and John Legend and The Roots. We love to see our crowds singing along to the music. To this day, I can't hear Fight Song, Roar, or Rise Up without getting emotional. Some people came to our rallies again and again. I got to know a few of them. A woman named Janelle came with her husband and daughter to a rally in Iowa headlined by Katy Perry, the first of many she did for me. Janelle had a homemade sign, 13th chemo yesterday, 3 more, hear me roar. She was in the process of fighting breast cancer. I was with Bill and we walked over to introduce ourselves. We had a nice long talk. Over the next 11 months, I saw her many times. She'd visit me on the trail, update me on her health, and her daughter would tell me how second grade was going. Janelle kept promising me that she'd see me at my inauguration. I kept telling her I'd hold her to it and she'd better be there. For my second debate against Trump in St. Louis, I invited her to come as my guest. My staff would bring groups of people backstage to meet me before I spoke, and those brief conversations were often very meaningful. I met a lot of women in their 80s and 90s who said how excited they were to finally vote for a woman for president. Many dressed up in pantsuits and pearls for the occasion. I imagined myself in 30 years putting on nice clothes, and going to hear my candidate speak. One, Ruelene Steininger, even caucused for me in Iowa when she was 102 years old. She made it very clear that she was going to be around to vote for me on Election Day, and she was. At an event at a large arena in New Hampshire, I stepped into a side room before going out to speak and met a group of public school employees. One of them, a man named Keith, who worked in a school library, told me his story. Keith was his mother's caregiver. She had Alzheimer's disease. He couldn't afford adult daycare or a home health aide, so he had to bring his mom with him to work every day. That stopped me in my tracks. He got a little choked up talking to me, and I got a little choked up hearing it. I thanked him for sharing his story. Later, I told my policy staff, who were already working on plans for Alzheimer's research and elder care, to think even bigger. On the rope lines at rallies, I encountered a feature of modern campaigning that has become far more prevalent since 2008, the selfie. There is no stopping the selfie. This is now how we mark a moment together. And to be clear, if you see me in the world and want a selfie and I'm not on the phone or racing to get somewhere, I'll be glad to take one with you. But I think selfies come at a cost. Let's talk instead. Do you have something to share? I want to hear it. Provided it's not deeply insulting, I have limits. I'd love to know your name and where you're from and how things are going with you. That feels real to me. A selfie is so impersonal, although it does give your wrist a break from autographs, now obsolete. Roundtable events were special. As I mentioned earlier, they gave me a chance to hear directly from people in a setting in which they felt comfortable. Sometimes those conversations were searing. I met a 10-year-old girl in Las Vegas who took a deep breath and described in a trembling voice how terrified she was of her parents being deported because they were undocumented. Everyone in that room wanted to give her a hug, but I was the lucky one. She came over and sat on my lap as I said what I'd say to Chelsea whenever she was anxious as a little girl. Don't you worry. Let me do the worrying for you. And also, you are very brave. We tried to make time for OTRs, seeing local sites and dropping by local businesses whenever we could. If we were running late, these would be the first to fall off the schedule, all the more reason not to announce them so no one would be disappointed if we couldn't make it. My personal preference for an OTR was anywhere that sold kids toys, clothes, or books. I would load up on gear for my grandchildren and the new babies of friends and staffers. I also picked up little presents for Bill on the road. Ties, shirts, cufflinks, a watch. He loves nothing more than to get something neat from a craftsman somewhere in America. It's just about his favorite thing. For me, fundraisers were a little more complicated than other campaign events. Even after all these years, it's hard for me to ask for other people's money. It's hard to ask someone to host an event for you in their home or business. But until the day comes that campaign finance reform is signed into law and upheld by the Supreme Court, if you want to run a viable national campaign, there's no way around it. You're going to have to do some serious fundraising online, by phone, by mail, and in person. I reject the idea that it's impossible to do it while maintaining your integrity and independence. Bernie Sanders attacked me for raising money from people who worked in finance. But I reminded him that President Obama had raised more money from Wall Street than anyone in history, and that didn't stop him from imposing tough new rules to curb risk and prevent future financial crashes. I would have done the same, and my donors knew it. I was grateful to everyone who gave money to our campaign or helped raise it. We tried hard to use every penny wisely. The campaign staff will attest that Robbie Mook in particular was downright stingy about travel expenses and office supplies. Snack budget? Absolutely not. Buy your own chips. Your own hotel room? Not a chance. Find a roommate. And while you're at it, take the bus instead of the train. We were all in this together. Our fundraising team worked around the clock. Our national campaign staff living and working on a tight budget. Me flying around the country going to fundraisers and our donors opening their wallets to show their solidarity and support. Our campaign had more than 3 million donors. The average donation was under $100. and ours was the first campaign in history for which the majority of donors were women. That meant a lot to all of us. Sometimes we just needed to have some fun. One beautiful summer evening, Jimmy and Jane Buffett hosted a concert for us at their home in the Hamptons on Long Island. I was the first presidential candidate Jimmy ever endorsed, and he wanted to do something special for me. So he, John Bon Jovi, and Paul McCartney played a set in a tent full of twinkly lights, and everyone danced on the lawn under the stars. It was magical. But my favorite events were with kids. They'd sit cross-legged in front of me on the floor, or join me on a couch, or drape themselves over chairs, and I'd answer their questions. What's your favorite part about running for president? Meeting kids like you. Who's your favorite president? With lots of love to Bill and President Obama, it's Abraham Lincoln. What are you going to do to protect the planet? Reduce our carbon footprint, invest in clean energy, protect wildlife, and fight pollution. The children listened with great seriousness and asked follow-ups. They were my kind of crowd. They also sometimes told me what was worrying them. For instance, the death of a pet or a grandparent's illness. Many kids asked what I would do about bullying, which made me want to become president even more. I had an initiative called Better Than Bullying ready to go. I had a lot of respect for the press corps who traveled with us. For the most part, it was comprised of embeds, journalists permanently embedded with us from the beginning of the campaign till the end. That meant they got to know us and we got to know them. A lot of the embeds were journalists in their late 20s and early 30s, which made this assignment a big opportunity for them. They worked as long and hard as we did. Some veteran reporters also joined us for stretches. Network anchors and big-time columnists would parachute in for interviews and a taste of the road, but they never stayed long. The traveling press corps asked tough questions. They were hungry. I had to admire that. With rare exceptions, they were also very professional. I can't say we were completely comfortable with one another, though. As I write elsewhere in this book, I tend to treat journalists with caution, and I often feel like they focus too much on the wrong things. I understand that political coverage has to be about the horse race, but it's become almost entirely about that and not about the issues that matter most to our country and to people's lives. That's something that has gotten increasingly worse over the years. That's not entirely the press's fault. The way we consume news has changed, which makes getting clicks all important, which in turn encourages sensationalism. Still, they're responsible for their part. Having said that, I respected them. Once in a while, we'd go out for drinks or dinner as a group and have a wide-ranging, off-the-record talk. I'd bring Halloween candy and birthday cake back to their cabin on the plane. They'd sometimes roll oranges with questions written in Sharpie up the aisle and try to reach my seat all the way in front. Sometimes on night flights, we'd put on music and open the wine and beer. When any of them were sick or dealing with family problems, that happens during a long campaign, I'd ask Nick to keep me updated. Some of the journalists also started dating one another, and that also happens during a long campaign. And since nothing makes me happier than playing matchmaker, I was always eager for the scoop. I also was delighted that many of the journalists assigned to our campaign were women. During the 1972 presidential campaign, the reporters who traveled with the candidates were called the boys on the bus. By 2016, it was the girls on the plane. A lot of days and nights on the trail can blur into one another. You'd be surprised how many times we had to ask each other, were we in Florida or North Carolina yesterday? It wasn't out of the ordinary for two people to answer at once, but with different states. But some days stood out, for better or worse. One of the best days ever was November 2nd, 2016, Game 7 of the World Series, the night the Chicago Cubs made history. We were in Arizona for one of our final rallies. It was a big one. More than 25,000 people came out. Before I went on stage, I asked for an update on the game. It was the top of the sixth inning. The Cubs led the Cleveland Indians 5-3. Gulp. Like everyone in Cubs Nation, I had been following the playoffs and the series with all my fingers crossed. I started watching Cubs games with my dad when I was a little girl, sitting on his lap or on the floor near his chair in the den. We'd cheer and groan, and at the end of the season, we'd say, "Next year we'll win the series." To assuage my disappointment, I also became a Yankees fan. It didn't feel disloyal because they were in the other league. Some people on my staff were fans, too. No one more than Conley, who, like me, grew up outside Chicago. She carried a huge W flag with her on the road, and every time the Cubs won, putting them one step closer to their first world championship in 108 years, she draped it on the bulkhead of the plane or wore it like a cape. Whenever we could, we watched the games together, holding our breath. That night in Arizona, when the rally was over, the first thing I asked was, "Who won?" No one yet. The score was 6-6 in the ninth inning. We had a 15-minute drive back to the hotel, but that meant maybe missing the end of the game. We couldn't risk it. Instead, Philippe, who was traveling with us for the final stretch, pulled it up on his iPad, and we all stood around him to watch, standing on a section of grass in the parking lot. Capricia Marshall, one of my close friends and the former chief of protocol at the State Department, was there, too. She's from Cleveland and is a big Indians fan, so she did some trash talking. Following an anxiety-inducing rain delay, the game went into extra innings. We stayed put in the parking lot. When Chicago recorded the final out in the bottom of the 10th to edge the Indians 8-7, Connolly was the happiest I've ever seen her. I reached for that W flag, and we stretched it out between us and took a million photos. Then we drove back to the hotel, ordered a bunch of food to my hotel suite, and watched the highlight reel, especially reliever Mike Montgomery's game-winning save, which he pulled off with a giant smile on his face, like he had all the confidence in the world that he was about to make our dreams come true. A much less fun day was September 11, 2016, the day I was sick at the National September 11th Memorial Museum. It means a lot to me to commemorate that solemn day, so missing this event wasn't an option. But I felt awful. I'd been fighting a cough from what I thought was allergies for at least a month, and saw my internist, Dr. Lisa Bardak, on September 9th. She told me the cough was actually pneumonia and I should take a few days off. I said I couldn't. She gave me strong antibiotics, and I went on with my schedule, including filming between two ferns with comic Zach Galifianakis that afternoon. The next day, I stuck to a scheduled debate prep session. On Sunday, when I got to the memorial, the sun was beaming down. My head ached. You know the rest. In a funny twist, when I arrived, one of the first people I saw was Senator Chuck Schumer, my friend and former colleague. "Hillary," he said, "how are you? I just had pneumonia." At this point, the fact that I had pneumonia wasn't public, so this was totally out of the blue. The difference between us was that Chuck didn't have to go out in public as a candidate when he was under the weather. He told me he had followed his doctor's orders and stayed home for a week. Looking back, I should have done the same. Instead, I ended up having to parade in front of the cameras after leaving my daughter's apartment, where I had gone to rest, to reassure the world that I was fine. Luckily, most of my memories of being in New York during the campaign were a lot better. I raced all over the city for the New York primary, hitting all five boroughs. I played dominoes in Harlem, drank boba tea in Queens, spoke at historic Snug Harbor on Staten Island, ate cheesecake at Junior's in Brooklyn, rode the subway in the Bronx, struggling with the MetroCard reader like a typical commuter, and had ice cream at a shop called Mikey Likes It on the Lower East Side. As I tucked into my ice cream, an English reporter who was part of the traveling press corps that day shouted, "How many calories are in that?" All of us, including the rest of the press, booed in response, me louder than anyone. In the end, we won the New York primary by 16 points. I went on Saturday Night Live and taped that episode of Funny or Dies Between Two Ferns, which was surely one of the more surreal experiences of my life. It's an odd thing to be a politician on a comedy show. Your job isn't to be funny. You're not, especially compared with the actual comedians, so don't even try. Your job is to be the straight guy. That's pretty easy, especially for me, whose life is basically taking whatever's thrown my way. The most important thing is to be game. Luckily, I'm game for a lot. SNL asked me to play a character named Val the Bartender, who would pour drinks for Kate McKinnon, who played me. "Would you sing Lean on Me together?" they asked. I said yes, even though I have a terrible singing voice. For a couple weeks after, people would shout, "Hey, Val," at me on the trail. On Between Two Ferns, when Zach Galifianakis asked me, "I'm going to sneak up on you in a gorilla mask, is that cool?" I said, "Sure, why not? You only live once." I marched in the 2016 New York City Pride Parade. Back in the day, in 2000, I was the first lady in history to march in a Pride Parade. This time, we had a big contingent from Hillary for America marching together behind a Love Trump's Hate banner. The New York City crowds cheered for us with gusto. Most importantly, Bill and I welcomed the arrival of our grandson Aiden on June 18, 2016, at Lenox Hill Hospital on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It was a sunny day with hardly a cloud in the sky. A prediction, perhaps, of his personality, he is the happiest little boy. It's hard to ask more of a city than that. There's one more group of days I want to describe because they're unlike any other. Debate prep. It's the debate prep team's job to put me through my paces so I'm not hearing anything for the first time during the actual debate. My team, led by Ron Klain, Karen Dunn, and Jake, helped me prepare for all 12 debates. Ron is a lawyer and veteran political strategist who served in the Clinton and Obama White Houses. Karen, also a lawyer, worked for me in the Senate and later for President Obama. And Jake, who knew every word of every one of our policies, was a champion debater in college and grad school. All three had helped prepare President Obama for his debates as well. They worked with two indefatigable campaign staffers, Sarah Solo and Christina Costa, to produce thick briefing binders for me, covering hundreds of topics. As a lifelong fan of school supplies, I fussed over the tabs and dividers and armed myself with a bouquet of highlighters in every color.